Hi, welcome to the Design Thinking Roundtable, a podcast which explores various aspects of design and how it can create change and social impact. I'm Anna Fayard, an ethnographer who researches, teaches, and practices human-centered design with a focus on social innovation and collaboration. And I love having conversations on design with passionate and mindful designers. Bon Ku is an emergency physician and professor at Thomas Jefferson University. As the director of a health design lab, he created the first design thinking program at a medical school. Bon co-wrote the book Health Design Thinking with Alan Lupton and was a regular panelist on the primetime medical TV show Chasing the Cure with Ann Curry. Hello, Bon. I'm really excited to have you today to talk with us on this Design Thinking Roundtable. I would like to start with your perspective on the role of design thinking or human-centered design. I don't know, I think you're using it interchangeably.
Yeah, I use them interchangeably.
And I heard you say that healthcare is the black hole of design, and it got me interested to think about, like, what do you mean by this? And if you could give me a couple of examples of how design and healthcare kind of intersect or where healthcare is missing design.
Yeah. Anne Lord, and I'm so excited to be on this podcast. I'm a huge fan of your work, so thank you for inviting me. And for healthcare being the black hole of design, I like to say that because if you think about some of our worst experiences as humans, many of us, those experiences are in a healthcare setting, whether you're a patient or a caregiver or a clinician. The experience of getting sick, of healing, of recuperating, of being born and dying are often a result of bad design. Those experiences can be so bad. So I'm a physician. I work in a busy hospital emergency room in Philadelphia. And, you know, we have droves of healthcare workers leaving the hospital. And that started before the pandemic, nurses and physicians quitting. There is a shortage of a workforce in healthcare. And I think a lot of it stems from just the poor experiences that we have as healers in a healthcare setting. And we've known for many years that the experience of patients and caregivers have been so terrible. I mean, we still routinely put patients who are sick in hallway stretchers in the hospital. It is inhumane. So every day I experience bad design, whether it's a product, a service, an experience, or a space.
And so I'm just curious because it's like everywhere you've seen it and you've been, you know, a doctor, a physician for many, many years. What has been the moment where, you know, suddenly you kind of clicked with this idea of human-centered design? Was there an event, you know, a meeting, something that kind of, you know, because I can imagine there are many people who, you know, are, you know, on your side who experience exactly the same thing, but they don't switch.
I'm not trained as a designer, but I think growing up, I've always been fascinated with design. I was this weird guy who looked at a lot of architecture magazines and buildings. I was just like obsessed with design of the built environment. And I just didn't know what to call it. I didn't know anything about design. And in healthcare, I've always thought, you know, why is this experience so terrible? Why can't my experience be as good as, you know, not to overplay, you know, the iPhone experience where I open it up, I intuitively know how to use it and it works. I had this opportunity about 7 to 8 years ago to start a design program at our medical school. So we're one of the largest medical schools in the U.S. I think we actually have more alumni than any other medical school in the U.S. because we've historically been one of the largest medical schools, and we're one of the oldest in the U.S. And our dean had this vision of redesigning medical education because the last major redesign of medical education actually happened in 1910 with the Flexner Report, like over a century ago. And so we have this model of 2 years in the classroom, 2 years in the hospital, where we do our clinical rotations. And there's been tweaks to that model that was designed in 1910, but essentially it remains the same. And medicine has seen a remarkable transformation with the scientific method and evidence-based medicine. But what's lacking is, how do we develop a creative mindset in addition to a scientific mindset in healthcare? And I had this opportunity to start introducing design to first-year medical students. And from that, we started developing principles and methods. And our goal is not to turn medical students into designers. You know, we want them to become doctors, but we want to expose them to principles and methods of design to start getting them to think like designers, because we believe that can help them to tap into their creativity to solve complex problems.
So, I mean, it's interesting what you're saying about creativity, because people don't necessarily see doctors are needing creativity. But I remember hearing you saying, like, you know, that medical training kills creativity. So I was like, curious, like, but listening to you, I can imagine also you have complex problem solving and you should be able to probably be creative, but
I argue we have the most complex problems. I mean, look at this pandemic. The most complex problems on the earth are around making people healthy, preventing people from getting sick.
So design thinking is a, you know, problem solving methodology. So I can see where is the intersection. What are these principles that you, I was thinking about it and I could think, of course, empathy, which is core to design thinking or human centered design, makes sense to think about it in medicine. But what are the other principles? I've seen you and I've, you know, the first time we met, it was about like you sharing your experience about the program you were doing. And I remember you mentioning rapid prototyping and, how does it fit into the medical profession? And what other principles do you have from design thinking that you're trying to teach these students to help them, as you say, not become designer, but become better doctors?
I love the design principle of prototyping, of getting an idea out of your head, giving it a physical form. And we teach that to medical students. And the prototyping that we often do is very low fidelity prototyping, you know, simple things that you might find in an elementary room art classroom, you know, paper and tape and string and pipe cleaners to help them give a form factor. But, you know, we also do high fidelity prototyping, and we did this during the pandemic. For example, those annoying nasal swabs that we have to test ourselves for COVID, we were actually running out of those in the summer of 2020, and because of supply chain disruptions. And we work with researchers and manufacturers who develop an open source 3D print file. So what we did was we actually converted our design lab at my hospital into an in-house manufacturing facility. And we used this open source file to 3D print 35,000 COVID swabs as a reserve if we ran out. And so we actually had to tap into some of that reserve. And it was just remarkable because we had this problem of there's a supply chain disruption, and we got together with researchers and manufacturers and developed this protocol rapidly of how can we 3D print this COVID swab that's safe, effective. We did a research study on it. And going forward into the next pandemic or epidemic, you know, I think rapid response design is going to be essential because we're going to have these supply chain disruptions again. And how can we use rapid prototyping to immediately come up with a solution? Because during the pandemic, we couldn't wait. We couldn't wait 6 months. We couldn't wait 6 days. We had to have a solution in 6 hours sometimes. And you know, I had a chance to work with a designer, Marcel Botha, based out of New York City, during the spring of 2020, there was this big fear that we were not going to have enough ventilators based upon what was going on in Italy during that time. So Marcel Botha, he's the CEO of 10X Beta, and they responded to a request from the city of New York to develop an emergency low-cost ventilator. So within a couple of, you know, less than 2 months, Marcel worked with the team at MIT, and they developed 3,000 ventilators for New York City as reserve stockpile. Thankfully, we did not need to use those ever, but that's an example of rapid prototyping that the pressing issue of the time forced them to tap into their creativity and start prototyping rapidly.
You know, one thing that I've noticed, you talked about working with, and I think, you know, that you worked with designers, with manufacturers, with researchers. And so I think that design thinking by definition is a very collaborative process. And so I'm curious, like, how do you see your work through the medical education to help doctors also become maybe better collaborators across disciplines? Because I can see how already as doctors, you're working with a lot of people within the hospital, but it's still, you know, there's always a difficulty at, like, you know, we all want to be collaborative, but sometimes it's harder. So how much do you, what is part of the training where you're helping people become maybe better collaborators, which would be very useful, I think, for our society in general?
I love this question because in my medical training, maybe because I'm older, I did not learn how to collaborate. It was always focus on the doctor being, you know, the quarterback of healthcare delivery and so focused on what the doctor does. But making people healthier is a team sport. It requires collaboration, and it also requires collaboration from the people that we are trying to serve, patients, communities, and their caregivers. So we try to embed this principle of co-design, not just designing for, but how do we design with patients, caregivers, and community? We implemented it during the pandemic, what we saw in Philadelphia, which is predominantly a minority city. And what we saw is people living in non-white, under-resourced communities were facing barriers to getting vaccinated. They weren't getting vaccinated at the rates that white Philadelphians were getting vaccinated. And so what we did, instead of going, okay, we're going to decide how to deliver vaccines to the community, our initial response was, you know, who are community partners that we can start learning from and co-design convenient vaccine and testing sites? And so we partnered with schools, nonprofits, churches, businesses, and we collectively thought about how we can reach their community because they know the community better than we do as clinicians. And so we had very successful vaccine sites distributed in under-resourced communities throughout Philadelphia, and we were able to vaccinate predominantly minority communities in Philadelphia. And we were only able to do this because of adopting this principle of co-design in how we thought about delivering vaccines. It would have been very different if we just said, okay, here are five neighborhoods in Philadelphia. We're going to start vaccinating people in those communities. But what we did was we tapped into the expertise of the communities.
Okay, so getting the communities to help you figure out where to go, and then also having them introducing you, I guess, was also maybe part of the support, is like not you coming from the outside, but you being invited, I guess, by the community to join.
Exactly, and being partners with them and treating them as experts.
So it's interesting what you said, like, you know, you were not trained as being a collaborator during your education. So as now you have the opportunity to really change medical education, you know, it's easy to tell people you have to collaborate, but it's harder to do. So what are the way you kind of getting people? Is it through these workshops around design thinking and having them to start realizing how they have to work together, or what are the way of doing it?
One way we do it is we invite patients and caregivers into our design workshop. So we just did one in California with an organization that is trying to increase diversity in clinical trial enrollment. And so we invited patients who themselves are undergoing, who signed up for a clinical trial to be part of the design workshop. So we embedded them with clinician researchers around the challenge of how might we improve the experience of a patient undergoing a clinical trial. And it's a totally different mindset of when we invite a patient or a caregiver into the design process. And it forces us to, from the onset, to think about how we can co-design with them instead of bringing them in later on in the process. And that's what happens a lot in healthcare, where we want the input of the patient or the community, but they come in way too late. And they may, that form factor may be a patient representative group or an advisory board, but how do we bring patients in early on in the process from day one? I think that will be key to delivering better product services and experiences. And we know companies are trying to do that as well. We know when we bring in the, you know, quote unquote end users early on in the process, we get better product services and experiences.
And so, and I guess what you're describing also is getting the physicians to get the perspective. So I don't know if it's empathy or sympathy, or I know there are debates about it, but like getting a sense of, you know, getting another point of view instead of you trying to fix things, but like figuring out something else.
Yeah, 100%. And why can't the patient who has lung cancer be part of the process of designing clinical trials when they themselves are the expert? They've undergone the experience. We just don't have that empathy of we can't be in their shoes and experiencing the fears, the anxieties that they're going through. And I think we need to be doing more of that, inviting patients and caregivers into the process, early on to the process, whether we're designing a clinical trial, whether we are designing a medical device or an experience or even a physical space.
So the program you're running, the Health Design Lab, is like groundbreaking. It's like the first one in the US. It's doing this amazing work. Like, how do you see it like scaling and being adopted by others? Because, you know, do all students go through your program or are they self-selected?
I love this question about scaling. So let me start off with the first. We have a subset of students. We have about 25 to 30 every year enter into our program. We follow them for 4 years. So we have at any given time 100 students in our program, which seems like a lot, but our med school is big. We have about almost 300 students per year. So we have over 1,000 students at our medical school. We're one of the largest in the U.S. And this concept of scale, I get asked this question a lot.
I'm sure.
And there's this tension of whether we scale up and become like a Cheesecake Factory, which is a big restaurant chain in the US, or we stay small and we're a small restaurant that has maybe 30 seats, but are creating some inventive dishes. And so right now we're more of that small restaurant. And in order to scale, we want to open source our design methods and principles that we have been developing over the past 7 years. So that's why I partnered up with Ellen Lupton, who is a really famous designer and author. And we publish a book called Health Design Thinking. So it's our cookbook for implementing design in healthcare. And I get a lot of inspiration from chefs and restaurants because I love food. And I think of Rene Redzepi of Noma and that restaurant in Copenhagen that always wins, mm-hmm. you know, best restaurant in the world. And he doesn't have restaurants in every continent, yeah. any country. He has one restaurant, and he's probably been the most influential chef in the history of the world. You know, one of them, like top three, definitely. And he's able to do this by only having one restaurant. So you can ask him, how are you going to scale? Mm-hmm. I'd say he's scaling already. He's so influential. So I think there is this pressure in med tech to scale like tech industries, you know, like Google and Amazon all getting into the healthcare space. But, you know, what we're trying to do is invent new recipes and scale by sharing our principles and methods, that there can be thousands of design labs in healthcare systems, that med tech companies can invite designers in to the process, that there would be an argument that we can merge design and health and healthcare. Because right now healthcare needs a lot more designers. We do not have enough designers in healthcare. And, you know, there are some organizations doing it, but I would love to see 10x the amount of designers that we have right now in healthcare, 100x, I think.
Thanks. I mean, I completely agree with you with the tension, because I tend to be also from the small restaurant kind of group. So I get it. I guess my question was, and I like the cookbook and the recipe, or the idea of having a template that you can all open source, and then having, you know, inspiring people to embrace it. I guess my question was not necessarily of you, you know, having the 300 students or like replicating, but to your point, is if you're really trying to change mindsets and really have an impact on how do we redesign healthcare services, is like, how do we inspire others? And I like the idea of using open source. And I guess each of your 20 or 30 students then go and work in other hospitals and kind of pass the message to a certain extent.
Yeah, one day they're going to be a CEO of a healthcare system, or a department chair, or a CEO of a pharma company or med tech company. And hopefully they will remember these design principles that they were taught and apply them in at scale.
The first time we met was at NYU Nursing School, where they were trying to incorporate design thinking within the curriculum for nurses. And there's a whole movement of, you know, nurses as makers. And so I'm just curious, like, how do you see, like, do you have conversation? Do you see people who are like, you know, nurses being interested in joining forces? And well, clearly in that conversation they were, but like, I'm just curious, like, because I think, as you say, there's like so much collaboration between different occupations within the context of a hospital.
I believe that nurses are more prime to adopt design thinking than physicians, because they spend the most time with the patient. And again, medicine, making people healthier, is a team sport. So adopting a designer's mindset is helpful, not only for the physician, but for the nurse, for the pharmacist, for the tech, for the administrator. I think everyone who works in, I don't want to say industry because I hate that term, but in on a team that's making people healthier, preventing people from getting sick, of healing people, can benefit from adopting design thinking principles and methods and seeing themselves as creative. Time and time again, I ask medical students and nurses and pharmacists if they think of themselves as creative. And most of the time they say no. And I think that is crazy, because we are all born creative, all born as creative individuals. Creativity is something that is not isolated to designers or people who dress all in black and look hip. You know, that I would say a nurse and a physician and a pharmacist are as creative as an artist or a musician. that creativity is actually as important in our field than it is in their fields. And we just don't see it as that. I think we have this bias in how we, in our educational system, that we label some people as creative and non-creative, some people as scientific and non-scientific. And that hurts us, because creativity is so important in making healthcare better. In 2020, I was listening to a podcast by Dr. Jim Kim. He co-founded Partners in Health with the late Paul Farmer and was led the World Bank at one time. And he said hunting down the virus will require creativity. And I love that he said that. For someone like him at his stature, that he said, this requires creativity. And we don't think we need creative people in medicine 100%. And creativity is a skill that can be taught. It can be cultivated. And I am a firm believer in that. I think if we can help people who work in our field to be more creative, then we are going to see better results.
So healthier patients and the stronger communities, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Good design is healthy design.
It seems like, you know, it's a call for creative processes in all fields and conversation across fields. I was thinking of like a number of examples that you gave in various talks, and I had a few questions for you just to finish, because you gave us like already a couple of examples, but I remember, you know, an example of patients generating their own electrocardiogram, a mask designed to be worn with a hijab, and even like rethinking emergency room signage. So it seems that, like, back to creativity, there are like so many places where you can change things. But like, is there one or two examples that, if you had to say that's like perfect example of a value of design for healthcare, you would want to share them as we're closing the episode?
There's so many. I love the one that you had mentioned about a signage in a hospital. I like to say, you know, graphic design saves lives. There is a UK-based design firm called Pearson Lloyd, and they work with the NHS system to tackle this problem of violence in emergency rooms. That's something that's common in the UK, very common in the US. I know many doctors and especially nurses who've been assaulted by patients. And they did this deep dive to understanding, you know, what causes that. And some of the problems stem from patients who are at their worst time in their lives, not knowing where they are in this process, you know, waiting hours and hours, sometimes even 12, 13, 14 hours to be seen and be treated. And so what they did was they created signage throughout the emergency department that explained where patients were in their process of getting treated, you know, whether they're waiting for an X-ray or a CAT scan, how long it was going to take. And simple signage for patients reduce actually violence towards healthcare staff. And I love that example, that it, because it's a low cost intervention. It does not involve AI, machine learning, VR, AR. It is simple signage. And I think there's so many opportunities like that to develop empathy for people in the process and come up with simple interventions that don't require a lot of money. And that's an example of good design is healthy design, and good design can help save lives.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad I suggested that example, because I think it's like such also an example of, for me, good design being invisible, like these small things that we don't think of. As you said, sometimes it's like we moving away, saying like, oh, it's going to be too expensive, or it has to be. But design, as you say, can be little things and can make such a huge difference.
Yeah, good design is often invisible.
So thank you so much for sharing. What I'm getting is design key, and it's healthy design for healthy communities and better health services, medicine as a team process, collaboration, And I think also this idea of creativity and bringing it back to our education system in medicine, but I guess in any field, I think we need a little bit more creativity these days.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This was amazing. I love the work that you're doing and I hope we can collaborate in the future.
Thank you for listening to the Design Thinking Roundtable, produced by the DESIS Lab and ERA Chair in Social Innovation at Nova SBE, in partnership with the Design Lab at NYU Makerspace. The podcast is produced at Fidelidad Creative Studio. If you think this episode might be of interest to someone in your community, feel free to share it. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.